Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel, we have Luke Stutters.
Hello.
John Epperson.
Hello, everyone.
We have a new panelist. We have Darren Bramer.
Greetings, everyone.
Now, do you want to remind people who you are? It's been a few weeks since we talked to you.
Yeah, definitely. So I am a freelance developer evangelist, which means I get to talk and write about technology, my favorite thing. And I also try to still do some coding as well.
Awesome. I'm Charles Max Wood from devchat.tv, doing the dev influencer stuff, devinfluencers.com/podcast. We have a special guest this week, and that is Jake Yesbeck. Jake, do you want to just introduce yourself, remind us how awesome you are?
Hey, thanks for having me. My name's Jake. I am head of engineering at a company called Nomad, and I like to blog in my spare time, and I've been using Ruby for a little bit over a decade now, so it's probably my favorite language.
Did you work your tail off to get that senior developer gig just to realize that senior dev doesn't actually mean dream job? I've been there too. My first senior developer job was at a place where all of our triumphs were the bosses and all the failures were ours. The second one was a great place to continue to learn and grow, only for it to go under due to poor management. And now I get job offers from great places to work all the time. Not only that, but the last job interview I actually sat in was a discussion about how much my podcast had helped the people interviewing me. If you're looking for a way to get into your dream job, then join our Dev Heroes Accelerator. Not only will we help you get the kind of exposure that makes you attractive to your dream employer, but you'll be able to ask them for top dollar as well. Check it out at devheroesaccelerator.com.
What does Nomad do?
Nomad is a way for property owners to maximize their rental income by joining the platform and basically having Nomad use our magic to enable them to get what's called a guaranteed rent. So every month you'll get rent regardless of what happens. And go check it out. Nomadlease.com is the name of the website.
Okay. So when you say rental property, it's not like Airbnb. It's like I'm renting it by the month.
Right. Like say you owned a house that you wanted to rent.
Okay. Cool. Very cool. There might be a few people out there, even in this audience, that are doing that. Real estate investing, stuff like that. Very cool. Well, we ran across your article about migrations and having models in migrations. I'll admit this is something that I have done and then I have paid for and then I have fixed my migration to not have the model in there because, yeah, I'm curious though, like what prompted this? Did you run into a problem with this?
I've run into problems with this before. And I thought that it would be a good idea to write about it. I thought, honestly, this was kind of a short blog post that I could just write and then publish. And then maybe three people would read it. And then I'd go about my day. But it actually sparked a whole lot of conversation in the Reddit thread that I posted to and got me invited here. So I guess I talked about something a lot of people have opinions on.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question more specifically, I've ran into this issue in the past. I've caused this issue in the past. And I wanted to be the person that could tell people why not to do it and an alternative.
Gotcha. So in your opinion, why shouldn't you do this? I mean, I have my opinion, but I'm curious. Yeah.
I think it's pretty circumstantial. There's a whole swath of people that probably will never run into this issue. Maybe you archive your migrations after 6 months or something. Maybe you work on a small team, or maybe you're the only person writing migrations on your team. Maybe you won't run into this. But if you run into it in a fast-paced kind of more startup-y environment, 6 months down the road, you run a migration or you have to get a new developer up to speed and they run through some amount of migrations, or you come back from vacation, you run migrations, any of these things could happen, and you hit a model that no longer exists, got renamed, or something happened to it. And it could be kind of a headache for people, especially someone who doesn't actually know maybe exactly why this is happening. Think of like a newish developer goes on vacation. 3 months later, they run migrations again, and their machine's broken for a day. They don't know why.
I tell you where I've hit this kind of thing. And that's, as you said, in a startup. And we had to get something done fast. And then we come back, we change the abstraction. And you end up doing things like completely renaming your classes and your tables. And this is where it's bitten me before.
Yep, same. You rename the model. And then it tries to go and do model stuff with a model that doesn't exist anymore. And it says, hey, I don't know what this class is.
So the right answer then is to
just do rake db drop, rake db schema load, and never use your migrations again, right?
Maybe. It could be some anti-patterns here and things that I've experienced as well, like people using migrations as a way to change data in development environments or add fixtures or something like this. Like weird kind of things that I've seen that has kind of, you know, sparked a little bit of this. And, you know, I think it's a good idea, regardless of if you don't even do those anti-patterns, to not do this because of encapsulation, single responsibility principle, and that like my migrations just care about the database, right? They don't care about my models, really. They care about the state of the database. And I can always guarantee that at time of this migration's running, the database looks like it thinks it should look. And reaching out to application code is like not something it really need to be doing.
Yeah, the thing that I've always done with this kind of stuff is I will drop the one-off data stuff into a rake task. And I'll run it that way. I'll do a one-off like this in your example, in your blog posts, where you're doing book.updateAllCountryUS, right? Where you're changing all the countries on all the books to US. I'll just put that in a rake task because I figure I'm probably just doing it once to set a baseline, right? And then from there, after that, they may change. People can enter other values. I'm never going to have to do it again. And so I just drop it into a rake task. I'll run it. I may actually delete the rake task after that because I don't need it anymore, right? And then if I ever need it again, I can go pull it back in because it's Git, right? It's in my history. But yeah, then I can just maintain it as a one-off in one place and I don't have to worry about it anymore.
I like that. I like the rake task approach. I like to extend that a little bit. And with large data migrations, I'll usually enqueue a job per row of thing I need to do, or maybe a batch of 1,000 IDs mm-hmm. that I want to do. And then I can use background processing to migrate my data over as quickly as I want. You know, I can scale up those workers and chew right. through thousands, millions of records without impacting end users.
Yeah, I definitely became over time a much bigger fan of, okay, so it's very important that we migrate this data at this point in time, right? So you can either, it doesn't really matter to me because it kind of depends on like how big your typical data migration might end up being. Like if you do this regularly, then I find that like you actually probably need to formalize a pattern, right? But if you just do it like a couple times in the life of your application and that's like it, then who cares? Just do a rake task, it's fine. But yeah, if you like end up formalizing it, right? Like create your rake task or your job, and your rake task can call a job if it's complicated or something like that. Who cares? But the thing is like what you want is something where you can say, okay, you know what? We migrated the data this one point in time. And now we can change the inner workings of this job later on down the line to basically be a no-op so that our migrations will still run. And we no longer care about like migrating data or whatever, because you know it's not like you migrate production repeatedly. What you do is you migrate a developer's machine. So a no-op is fine or whatever.
Yeah, I did like your temporary model solution. That was kind of nifty.
I like that too. It actually, I've used it in the past, but it didn't come to me when I was writing this post. It actually was one of the comments on the Reddit thread. So credit due to that person. But I like it because you can do all the things that you wanted to do, which is call a method on a model or call a helper method of some kind. And it's on the real model that you want it to be. You can either define that method there or you can define the model that just wraps the table and use built-in active record functionality. And it's a little bit nicer than just doing raw SQL. But I usually just reach for raw SQL if I absolutely have to do complicated stuff in migrations. It might be a little bit odd, but no, I don't mind it.
Yeah, that's a way around it too, right? Because you're not dependent on Ruby definitions. Sorry, go ahead, Darren.
No, that's okay. I think using the SQL in there is actually a nice approach because these are kind of one-off things. So you probably know what you're doing. You're not worried about validations or other logic. You probably don't want other logic that's going to be directly in the model class. So I think doing it this way, you kind of encapsulate it. You don't really care the details of how that migration step happens. You just want to know that it works. So I think that's kind of a nifty approach. I will add one other thing that you all talked about earlier. I've certainly run into a number of other things, but I haven't hit that case of refactoring the model classes because you all are just braver than I am. I generally don't, even if I don't like them, I kind of think of the models as part of the database schema or tied to it. And generally speaking, I'm only adding to, or, you know, I'm really not, or making it less restrictive. I'm generally trying not to make any breakable changes or changes to my schema. So you all are braver than me in that respect.
I actually think that's like a good point, right? Like, so the only way that you introduce this problem in the first place, or the only way that the only common use case that I could think of, right, is basically, hey, I legitimately, you know, renaming models is a great way to make it happen, adding namespaces or something like that, right? But it's always like a thing where you're refactoring, where you're like changing, basically undoing something in the past, right? And like, I also have a tendency to like kind of look at my models folder as being like an add only. That's not always the case. And obviously I edit my models, right? But I've always been of the ilk that I don't encounter this very often because I don't rename my models very often, and I don't like that kind of thing. And so you can duck the whole problem, is I guess what I was trying to get at.
The downside is
that you end up with some class names or table names, things that you wish, oh, I wish we would have named it differently or structured it differently. So not refactoring, of course, has its downsides as well. But sometimes you're left with a few kind of tables hanging out there, models hanging out there that you just kind of have to live with.
Few things are as stressful as running major migrations on production databases. I know you've got a very strong database background, Jake. Do you enjoy refactoring your database structure?
You know, I don't actually mind it all that much. It doesn't scare me, I guess, as much as it might for some people, because I've just done it so much over my career. You know, I've worked at a lot of small, scrappy startups, and we've changed things. And one of the things I've noticed is that even if I want a table to be named something, if people in and outside of engineering refer to the concept that I'm encapsulating as a different word, I find myself eventually renaming it to the word that they want. So a great example is I worked at a place and they had this concept of leads, right? So you would capture a lead and then somebody would go follow up on the lead.
It's like a sales lead.
Exactly. And so they decided later on that they wanted that to be named an interest because they thought that sounded less salesy. It was an interest. Somebody had an interest in the product. And so we had the leads table, but we talked about interests all the time. And it bled into engineering conversations. It bled into architectural. Like we were talking about, well, how do we get more interests? And then we're inserting into a leads table. So at some point we decided, okay, this thing has 10 million rows, but we got to rename it. It's got to be called interests. And after that, the kind of confusion went away because new developers were coming in saying, okay, I hear you guys talking about interests, but I don't see that table. Where is that? Update the interest. What do you mean? So that's one example.
I'm definitely of your opinion, Jake. For me, it's much more important to have the database structure and the interface that I have to the data match the conversations that I'm having than the other way around. And I can refactor it. I can refactor all of it. And so step one is make sure that we're all communicating clearly. And step two is back up the database.
You know, so many times it comes back to the saying that there's really only two difficult things in computer science: naming things and cache invalidation. Uh-huh. Naming things is incredibly, incredibly hard. And yeah, I hear you. It is great when all of the names align all the way through, and every once in a while you're on a project where that actually is true. Otherwise, you kind of have to bite the bullet and do that refactor.
I'm a lagger in that regard. I like to kind of like wait until so the bigger your team is, right? Like the more important that is. Like I feel like a small teams, like your locales file is a great place to solve this problem. But if you're not, if you're like a much larger team, like I'm just like, okay, well, let's wait for like the name to settle in, and like just in case they decide they don't like the name anymore that they just came up with before I'm willing to. I don't know. I like to be dragged along. I definitely am not on the bleeding edge of changing it.
There's a certain balance to that, but
yeah,
if you the further you kick that down the road and the more work you do with the old name, the more technical debt you introduce. And so I am definitely a fan of once you're fairly certain that it's taken hold, go do the work. Because And again, you know, back to the idea of add only on the models, I'm of the opinion, you know, if you don't need it, make it go away, because you don't want to maintain it. You don't want to manage it. You know, if you don't need it, make it gone. And again, I don't know, for me, having the clean interface and making it maintainable, the trade-offs for that are much higher. You get much more value out of that than you do out of, say, making it backward compatible or making it so that your data cleanly migrates. You know, I'll go maintain my migrations to make that happen. So
I just think long as you stay away from the zealotry of anything, you'll be okay. Yeah. Right? Like, as long as you're willing to say, I like this thing, but this is totally an exception to the rule, and I'll just bite the bullet this time.
Yep.
I think you're spot on there. I always come back to, how can I make people care about as little as possible that work with me in terms of the architecture that I design? So if I need to bite the bullet, like you said, and maintain a kind of a gnarly piece of code, but they get a clean interface to work with, I'll do that every time.
Mm-hmm. I guess on the schema refactoring, I have the add only or only make less restrictive sort of drilled in my head, because I worked at Amazon using, and it's a ledger-based database, and it's similar to what blockchain data would be. So essentially, once you put data into that data store, it is immutable. It's forever there. So it actually forces you to behave according to this philosophy.
Right. That's a hard constraint.
It's a tough constraint that most people don't have. Now, as people move to blockchain and dApps and things like that, maybe it becomes a little bit more at the forefront. But yeah, for the most part, you don't have that hard constraint.
That didn't work out for Fastly this week, though, did it? The data only going in and never going out.
Uh-oh, what happened to Fastly? I didn't hear this.
This is for future, you know, listeners, this is a topical reference. Most of the internet went down earlier in the week when someone at Fastly misconfigured their Amazon cloud and took down pretty much 85% of everything I read.
Oh, jeez.
I don't know if everything went down, but it was big.
It's about 2 hours, right?
It was too long. Yeah. I don't know how long it was. I actually was like heads down during the time, so I like dodged to that bullet. It's better than all the times when I've gotten the unicorn page and I've just been like, no, I need to deploy like right now or something.
Well, you missed out on that cold shiver that runs down your spine. We think, is it us? Is it me? No, it's Amazon. Thank goodness.
Yes, that is nice.
I was looking at your blog post, Jake, about the temporary models, and that's implemented by defining a class in the migration class, which inherits from application record. And I was looking at application record thinking, what on earth is that? And it's a Rails 5 change that I never knew about. They changed the inheritance of active record. I was looking at this going, where is application record coming from? And there we go. That's my knowledge of Rails ran out, obviously, at Rails 4 point something.
Yeah, that. And I'm not sure if I posted it in the blog or not, but now active record migrations have a little identifier at the end of the class definition for which version you're working with too. So that one bit me when it, I think, upgraded from 4 to 5 or maybe 5 to 6. I'm not exactly sure.
Yeah. I want to say it was 5 to 6 is when it became imperative.
Yeah.
So there's one more pattern that I happen to have encountered during my career. I don't think this is a common pattern, so it may or may not be familiar to you guys. But I worked at a place where there was an entire separation of data migrations from schema migrations. And there's some interesting things that come with that, including a completely new class of problems that people probably aren't familiar with, which is that you inherently, so today, when you run migrations, all your migrations get run in order, in chronological order. And so there's a really cool benefit to that, which is that it inherently keeps things in order for you, because there's only one thing and that's always kept in order. But if you separate, so this particular thing, one of the big problems that we eventually had was, once you separate your chains of data migrations and schema migrations, the big con of it was that now you didn't actually have the order in which everything happened when together. So if you wanted to run from beginning to end, you could no longer really trust it. So that was the cons. The pros, though, were that you got to skip over this problem entirely. Your data migrations were completely separate. So you ran them. We ran a separate process. Like when we did a deploy, we would migrate our schema and then migrate our data. And that always, you know, obviously you can get into some ordering issues even there. But for the most part, that took care of us pretty good. It became a problem when we moved to Docker for things. But it actually, in some respects, it actually was okay when we went to Docker because we could wait to do data migrations, but that was a manual choice, right? As opposed to like an automated thing. So I don't know. I had encountered that one. I don't know if any of you guys have ever seen that in the wild or whatever. Obviously it's not my favorite, but it's a thing that obviously some people have chosen to do.
Yeah, I'm still not sure I completely follow what you're...
Gotcha. No problem. It was a homegrown, like basically mostly... is basically like rake tasks in a certain namespace with a certain naming scheme, right? That would keep them all in order. And basically that would allow you to do your data migrations. So for example, if you wanted to do your books.update all kind of thing, right? Like you would go put them over here in these data migrations rather than in your schema migrations, which is where you add stuff to your table and things like that.
Right.
Did it have another table like schema migrations called like data migrations that you would keep track?
Yep. It had its own complete separate system, but it was somewhat similar to how Rails internally handles schema migrations. Yep.
I renamed my migrations. I can't look at a migrations folder with the timestamp at the start. It just offends me. I obsessively, compulsively rename all my migrations to 2 or 3 digit numbers at the start. I just can't look at a timestamp. Sorry.
Okay. What happens? I have a question about that. And actually, I noticed this in your article too, Jake. What happens when you have a widely distributed team, right? And I make migration number 10, and you make migration number 10, and somebody else makes migration number 10, and we go to merge our stuff together. How do you deal with conflict resolution? Especially...
Alphabetical order.
Go ahead. Yeah.
So what about if I use the generator and you don't, right? So mine have timestamps on them and yours doesn't. Like, it's just, I guess at a glance, the directory looks crazy, but Rails knows what to do because it has the timestamp still in the beginning of the migration, right?
Then in code review, I reject your code and say, go use the generator. That's what I do. I'm not saying that's the right answer. That's just...
This doesn't play well with a large teams or, in fact, anyone else. But I just I just can't stand looking in a migrations folder and my mind is taken up by the first 6 characters or whatever's going on. I just find it distracting. And often if it's a date, I'll think, oh, yeah, that was last March. What was I doing last March? You know, and then it's gone. I'm just disappeared into that date, that timestamp, and I've forgotten why I was in the folder in the first place.
You can't just easily read 16-digit numbers and order them in your head without problems at all.
Man's got to know his limitations.
back to your joke.
I get you.
Back to your data migration, though. I've seen something vaguely similar to that in the past, and the thing that stuck out to me was that I have a hard enough time reminding people to do RakeDB migrate. I can't imagine having to remind them to RakeDB migrate, RakeDB data migrate, RakeDB test prepare, all this other stuff. Because you know you get people and like, my tests don't work. Why? It's like, okay, well, did you do this plethora of things that you're supposed to do? You know, assuming we don't have some kind of custom tooling that does it for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of custom tooling that does it for them.
Yeah, that's what we run. I mean, I always comment it out, but it's in there by default.
See, I have a differing opinion on that, I guess. I think it's valuable. And I think it probably enables a lot of good workflows for your team members. But the way that I learned Git was from custom tooling. Somebody wrote a bunch of Git scripts to, you know, do rebasing and automatic fast forward merging and stuff with some nice little tooling. And then I moved companies and I no longer had that tooling. And I had no idea how Git actually worked. So I had to basically relearn it all from scratch. So I lean mostly into custom tooling to enable workflows and make things faster, but somehow also learn what the tooling does. So I haven't found a good balance of that by just giving people tools versus letting them figure it out. What have you all experienced in this?
Yeah, I find that, yeah, it's kind of the same thing, right? because sometimes you do have to go down a level, right? The more common things, especially if it's a common workflow as opposed to just a common step, then yeah, like the fast forward merge, blah, 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 blah. Yeah. I don't need to remember all the flags and steps and blah, blah. Yeah. Versus, okay, this isn't a common thing, or this is just an easy step, like get push. Yeah. I don't need a fancy little shortcut script. I can just remember git push, right? But if I understand the underlying tool, then if I need to figure out why it's not doing what it's supposed to do, then I should be able to go down a level or quickly Google Stack Overflow and get an answer without being completely lost on what's going on.
I definitely separate my answers for my own personal growth and personal tool usage from my answers for how I like try to enable like my teammates, right? So I've come to accept over the course of my career that like, all right, so if you have 10 people, I don't know, somewhere between 1 and 5 of them, like if you enable them via tools, they're going to be perfectly productive or whatever. And that's totally great and totally fine. And they're going to be awesome developers. But if you take away their tools, they're going to be very crippled, right? And that's fine. Like, because if you enable them, then they're awesome, right? So I accept that for other people, that's cool. But for my own self, right, like it's very important that, like, I have a personal rule that like, I can only use tools for things that like, I understand intimately and very well. So I can use the tool to shortcut it. But then if I can do that, because then if I need to get under the covers to figure out what's broken, I can. I can't be blinding myself, right, by using a tool, which I then am then suddenly crippled when the tool stops working, right? As you pointed out. Like I do set that personal rule for myself. But I don't think it's a good idea for me to do that for my team. I think it's totally okay to create tools for my team on the flip side. So I'm a big believer in those two as a completely separate thing.
Yeah, I agree with John, what you and Jake, the points that you're making. I think the challenge is most of these tools that teams put together, unless they're really a product or an open source project that's been around for a long time, there's going to be a point where they become a leaky abstraction. They don't handle some edge case, or they don't do everything you need. And now you're kind of stuck and you have to go under the covers and use a git command in this example to do it anyway. And so that becomes the challenge. You know, most of them are leak the abstraction at some point and you have to dig in through what's actually going on. So it's always good to understand that.
I'm also going to point out though that, yeah, if you just want to kind of coast in your career, then being the person that's just going to use the tools and not necessarily understand the underlying technology and stuff, that's fine, right? Just go along, right? But if you're ambitious, if you want to move up, then it's going to limit you to not understand the underlying stuff. And so I may have come across as, I guess, critical of people that don't understand the underlying tool, but realistically, what I'm saying is that, yeah, if you want to be that senior dev that people are relying on to enable the team and take the lead on some of this stuff, then you're going to have to understand the underlying stuff. You have to understand the architectural stuff. You're going to have to understand under the covers of Rails. You're going to have to understand under the covers of some of this stuff. If you want to show up and contribute code to the team and do a little bit of open source work and feel fulfilled in your job, then you could probably get away with not understanding some of that stuff. I think neither of those is wrong, right? It just depends on what you want.
I did want to caveat a little bit, because I actually agree with most of what you're saying too, right? Except that I would also tweak it a little bit. I would say that there's also kind of that group of people that like, there's kind of like a portion of development that they kind of coast in. They're like, mm-hmm. They have great expertise over here, and maybe their Git foo is a little lacking and they just kind of rely on their teammates, right? Or maybe they're really awesome at Git, right? And maybe they're a little lacking somewhere else, right? Like maybe they don't care about the database and they come to me and they're like, hey, John, I'm like, I don't know what's up with this query. Just give me a hand here, right? Like, and that's fine. Like, that's totally cool. Cause I know that like, sure, I can write JavaScript just fine. And I can write front end stuff just fine, but I don't like it. So whenever I get paired up with a coworker that like loves that front end stuff, I'm not gonna lie, like we figure that out, And I'm like, you give me those tickets that you don't like, and I'm going to give you more of these front end tickets, right? Like, and mm-hmm. that works out. I think that's fine too, if that makes sense. You lean into your strengths.
I totally agree.
Yeah, I do too. And I think that especially early on in your career development, there's just so much to learn. So using the tools in a certain area that you don't really have the time or the drive to dive deep into yet, and then later stop using the tool and get into it. Because, you know, for your job, you know, if you know Git really, really well, but then you can't actually produce any of the code you're paid to produce, then you know, that's an issue.
Yes. Hopefully you're contributing while also being an expert at Git. Sweet.
Now you just have to commit code every day for a whole year.
Speaking of, I first heard of you, Jake, from your, how would you describe it? Your odyssey of open source, your open source ordeal. How would you describe this project?
It was an initiative, a self-imposed challenge for me to contribute to open source at a scale that some would say was ridiculous. So back in 2014, I think now, geez, I went to RailsConf and it was my first one. And I'd seen a lot of the big names around, and I met some of the people that I'd just seen their handles on GitHub and used their technology to work. And I thought to myself, wow, these people are legit. Open source development, that's where you get to be. You give conference talks, you hang out, you just seems great. And so I talked to a few of them and I said, how do I get involved in open source? It seemed very daunting to me. I was like, this seems like, you know, an elite status that I'm not near. And they said, just do it. And I said, oh, okay, sure. And so then
that's very specific advice.
Right. It's just do it. Just do the thing. And so then I, on the plane ride home, I wrote a post and I said, you know what? I'm going to do this for a year. I'm going to contribute to open source every day. At least one commit for a year, because I'm the type of person that if I have a consistent goal or something that's consistent every day of my life, I actually end up doing it and I do it pretty well. But if it's something where it's like, well, I'll do it when I can, or I'll do it days that I'm not too busy, I was never going to accomplish this. So for a year, I contributed to open source, my own projects and others. So that was a big learning at the beginning, is that finding a project every day and then ramping up on it and then committing to it every day was kind of ridiculous. I did that for the first week and it was like 4 or 5 hours a day of just being able to get one simple commit out. And, you know, that was a time in my life where I could spend that amount of time. I couldn't do that now, but back then I could. And I quickly found out that it was just not sustainable to do somebody else's open source code every single day for a year. So I peppered in a bunch of my own commits too.
Hey folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
Yeah, that sounds like an enormous headache to essentially take on a brand new project every single day. And I mean, I'm guessing you're actually trying to do this properly. You weren't trying to cheat and just open an issue on it. You were trying to actually add a feature when you're committing to these projects.
Right. Yeah. I was trying to really get a feel for what it would be like to, in my free time, also contribute to open source. And it was probably the most rewarding and impactful year of my development life. And I got so much out of it. It's actually crazy.
Hold on a second. Anyone who's been paying attention to recent developments in open source knows that being an open source developer is an enormously stressful, time-consuming, unprofitable, and downright awful experience. And here you are saying that you did open source and you had a good time. On a more serious note, do you think there has been a culture shift between 2015, 2016, when you were doing this, and the challenges people are facing in open source today?
I think so. I think that the mentality has shifted into, you know, what am I getting out of it a little bit more than I would like to see? And I never had, it was popular back in the day to have those little like buy me a coffee links on your profile and stuff. Mm-hmm. And like, that was the extent of like, hey, contribute to me. I'm writing code. please give me caffeine, right? Now there's a plethora of ways that you can support the person that is maintaining your tooling. And for large tools, I think that that's valid. If you spend a regular work day's amount of time every day on a tool used by hundreds of thousands of people, you should probably be compensated for that. And, you know, there should be ways for you to do that. But if you're getting into open source for monetary gain, I don't think that's the best idea.
Yeah, there's definitely some figuring out going on, right? Where, I mean, I attribute the attitude that you were describing, Luke, right? And that you're kind of describing from a different way, Jake, right? Like that you're just a sort of entitlement is what I was hearing from you, Jake, right? Like, okay, not that extreme, but this idea, right? That like, it's a burden, right? Like, oh man, I've got to write open source every day versus like what you're describing as your journey, Jake, is like, this was actually really cool because I got to write all this open source every day, right? Like, it's just different. I don't know. I feel like the community, I mean, we hear about it all the time, right? Like, we're always talking about like, how the heck are we going to pay for all this stuff? So, I mean, I kind of just attribute it to that big mess right there, which is that people are still figuring out how to make good business models out of open source.
It's funny too, because I've been doing the dev influencers stuff and I've been doing the strategic calls with people, right? Where I usually just talk to them about, you know, where they're at and where they want to end up. And then we start talking about some of the challenges that they're facing regarding where they want to get to. And I've had at least two people come to me and basically say, well, I want to get paid to work on open source full time. And that's pretty much the extent of their plan. And it's, to some extent, it makes sense, right? And some of it's a desire to work on stuff that gives back to the community full time. But some of it's also an extent to just, they see these people who are elevated in some way in the community and they want to have a piece of that, right? And, or they want to get paid to just work on cool code or things like that. And I keep talking to them and going, well, what are you doing working on open source now, right? Because most of the people that I know that are making it full time working on open source, you know, people like Evan Yu and some of these other folks, they were contributing to open source long before and in quantities much more than other people. And then it kind of came back around to the point where they were making money contributing to open source, where Evan was able to set up a Patreon, I think is what he did. Or Michael Rogers became the director, I think it was, of the Node Foundation, right? And so he was getting paid to run the Node Foundation. I don't think he was actually writing code, but he was running the Node Foundation, right? And then they were distributing money to other people to contribute to the JavaScript ecosystem, right? And so you have some of that stuff, like Ruby Together gives money to Rubyists to work on Ruby projects, right? I don't think they support anybody full-time, but I think they support some people for some of their work. Right. But these are people that are already contributing, right? It doesn't typically work the other way around where it's like, oh, we have this stuff that needs to be done in the open source community and we're taking applicants. It just doesn't tend to happen that way like it does for a job. And so anyway, it is interesting to see kind of how that ecosystem evolves. But the other part of this that I think is really interesting is, and I'd love to hear, Jake, what benefits you saw as far as like personal growth and as far as just relationships and sort of reputation or notoriety in any way, right? As far as, yeah, you know, how it helped people get to know who you were and then, yeah, who you got to meet and get to know and build a relationship with that way. And then, yeah, the personal growth with as far as like skills and things you learned.
For sure. Right. I meant it when I said that it was the most impactful year of my career because of the kind of forcing myself to improve my skill set because I was diving into code bases that was completely foreign to me with nobody holding my hand through it. So it was up to me to kind of splunk down and see what was
going on. Welcome to open source.
Right. Exactly. Right. And so it's very different from my professional career in which I always had somebody that I could talk to. I was engineer one at one company, but not for very long. And so I always at least had somebody that I could talk to about things. But with open source, you don't have that. And the issues that you're trying to fix, they're not very descriptive a lot of times. This doesn't work is a good issue, right? And so then you're just like, okay, let's figure out what doesn't work. So that was a really big thing. And I start to be able to kind of pattern match to different repos and be like, okay, I kind of guess where the logic is going to be for this. And I could, you know, traverse code very quickly and I could find issues. I could see things that shouldn't be there a lot faster over time. And so that was like a technical skill of mine that I really got. And the way that different people wrote code, because I don't think RuboCop had been, RuboCop was popular at the time, but it wasn't like as widely adopted. It wasn't just absolutely standard that everybody used it. So people wrote Ruby a lot differently than I think they even write Ruby now, 5 years later. Got to experience a lot of that too. Saw some cool projects. One of the things that that had nothing to do with programming was that I would write a blog post every Sunday also during this to kind of capture what I'd been working on or my thoughts about the process. And that was just as impactful as the coding was, because I think, and I still think, everybody should have a blog. I really do. I think you should write. I think you should put your thoughts out there. I think it's a great exercise to have you really ruminate on something and say like, okay, now how do I give that to an audience? And that feedback cycle was also great for me too. Seeing people that enjoyed my stuff was very awesome. And I have never and will never try and monetize my blog. I don't put ads on it. I don't like pay people to write on it or get paid or anything like that. But I love it. I think it's great. And now I have an entire portfolio of my open source contributions, my blog posts and stuff that everybody can see about me. And I got to tell you now, as a hiring manager, that is an awesome thing when I see somebody with an actual footprint that I can look back and say, okay, interviewing is interviewing. We all know how it is, right? So instead of just spending 4 hours deciding if I want to work with you forever, maybe if I had a, you know, catalog of your previous posts, your work, something that makes you stand out a lot and has something that has been something that I found in my career already. People reaching out to me for like, hey, I've really liked this blog post, I really liked this open source package you wrote, something like that. And would you like to interview? And, you know, that kind of thing I think is super valuable as well. In terms of relationships, I wish I had more really rock solid relationships with somebody. Like, I wish I made some really awesome friends that I kept in touch with. But, you know, I see some people from time to time. There was a few people that were very, very interested in a couple of my repos, and they would be very quick to point out when I didn't cut a release correctly and help me to do that, because it was new for me. I didn't know really what I was doing. I'd made gems, but not like, I didn't tag my commits correctly and make it nice for them to determine like the breaking changes I was introducing. So yeah, it was overall just amazing. And I don't think everybody could do it in terms of like their time commitment. I don't think I could do it now, frankly, but if you can do something like that and get into the community, I think it's great.
Have you heard of Phileas Fogg and his journey around the world?
I think everyone should do that.
It did put me in the mind of a kind of an amazing open source journey across disparate code bases in an increasingly more unlikely series of vehicles or classes. The nice thing about this is that you had such a positive experience. Now, I uploaded some code last week. I talked about it. I made a very small gem and I got code anxiety about that. I was a bit worried people would look at my code and laugh at it and possibly phone my employer and tell them about this awful code. No, this sounds ridiculous, but I think a big reason why especially junior developers don't upload code is that they're worried that something will go wrong and they don't have the confidence to do it. Do you encourage your junior engineers to do what you did? And if you do, how do you do it?
100%. And I will tell you that the first large-scale PR I did, I think I read through every character 10 times before I hit that submit pull request button, because I had the similar angst of like, oh, someone's going to see my code. I'm just some developer. They don't know me. This is going to be bad. But it turned out to be fine. And it's kind of funny, the more I did it, the little people actually read the code that I was trying to put up there. Just like, I put a PR up and then 10 minutes later, it's like, oh yeah, it's in there. Okay, thanks. You did free work for me and it doesn't matter what it looks like. Just thank you. So, but for the people earlier in the career, I like to point them to blog article I wrote about contributing to open source. It had like some clickbaity title, like contributor 7 steps or something, you know, back when that was popular. And it's just find something that interests you. Like I used code triage to find a lot of the issues that I wanted to work on, which is a application developed by Schneems and out of Heroku. And I would go to like the fifth or sixth page, not the gigantic repos, but like the ones that still had some issues that I thought that I could fix. Read the README a lot to determine like what they want me to do. Some people are very particular about like, I want you to make a branch in this name. I want you to do this. I expect, you know, your name to be added to this list kind of thing. And then write code like you would be writing code at work, you know, like make it as professional as you can. Add tests, conform to style guide. Don't have to go super overboard. Like one simple PR shouldn't take you like 3 months. I mean, maybe it does, but it's really not that big of a hurdle once you get past that first one. And I think that once you do that, you build a lot of confidence too. Like my confidence shot up through that year, like really shot up. You know, we talk about it a lot. Like people talk about imposter syndrome and stuff and, you know, feeling like you're not as smart as you think you are and all sort of stuff. And I've definitely had that throughout my career some, but this year of commits really helped both stifle that and build my own confidence of like, yeah, I kind of know what I'm doing.
Jake, I think one of the interesting things you called out, you know, your journey was about, the focal point was about writing or contributing code. But it's interesting what you said. I wanted to poke at it a little bit more. It sounds like the biggest skill or development or area where maybe you became more productive was actually in reading code. Because as developers, we probably spend more time reading code than we do actually writing code. And it sounds like that's where you actually gained a lot. I'm curious about that. And also you mentioned that you kind of noticed patterns, how people structured their code. Could you say a little bit more about that? Or maybe give us an example of a pattern that you started to see or how that helped your productivity?
Well, so it wasn't universal, the patterns that I would see, but I kind of would understand mostly about, I guess, how gems worked and how files were loaded. Because coming from Rails, you get kind of spoiled with the eager loader, right? Everything is loaded as long as it's under app. And you can put some other files or other directories in your configuration. Those get auto-loaded too, but stuff is loaded. It kind of doesn't matter what order things are loaded in. They're just all loaded in, right? Namespaces are automatically done for you, all sorts of stuff. And so I started to notice people's like manipulation of like load path and stuff and like how that worked and how they structured their actual business logic versus their, you know, top level things. Because most of the stuff I worked on was gems, you know. A few cases I worked on full Rails applications that people used. One was called like Grow Stuff, which was for something with like gardening and like enabling people to do something with that. But I think it was mostly around the structures of where does the logic I think I need live and how I can find that, because I use Vim, so I don't usually have like a very rich like view into the directory structure at all times. I kind of do a lot of like global searching and command T searching of like, this file is probably called this. So that's what I mean there. But in terms of reading code, I remember early in my career, I used to look at complicated code and say, I don't know what that does. Doesn't matter. I'm not writing it. I will maybe change a little bit of it, but this other stuff over here, this is magic, right? A lot of stuff was magic, you know, especially metaprogramming. When people go nuts with metaprogramming in Ruby, it's really easy to be like, oh, this is just magic. And then once you don't have anybody ask how the magic works, or you don't, you know, you're not able to just abstract around it, because who wants a PR to their code base? It just has a wrapper class that does the exact same thing that you're supposed to do, but like over here, right? Nobody wants that. So you end up having to change the existing code, and a lot of the existing code might not have specs. So the way that I really got good at this is that before I got started, I would write tests for the thing I was going to change if they did not exist, assert existing functionality, and then make the change that I wanted to change. And that whole process is longer, but I got a really good idea of, okay, how do I bootstrap tests onto existing code bases? Okay, how do I analyze logic I didn't write? And that was very helpful for me.
Yeah, that also helps get your PRs accepted faster when the reviewer looks and they see 2/3 of it is actually test and only 1/3 is a change.
Oh, I'll bet.
They're just like, oh, you're adding tests? Oh, I don't care about anything else. It's in.
I know, right? It's like adding docs. All right, we're kind of getting up there in time. Do you have any recommendations if somebody else is looking at this and going, all right, this looks like something that I want to do? Like, how would you recommend somebody else get in and get going on this?
Well, besides my advice that I received, which is just go do it, I would say check out Code Triage to find issues for stuff that you want to work on, or go to one of your favorite repositories and look at the issues to kind of get a flavor for what kind of requests are coming in. And if it's a huge repository, usually the issues might be a little bit more advanced for a first-time commit. Nothing wrong with starting with documentation changes. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with doing something like translations. You speak another language and they need you to write a translation. I need translations written for some of my gems in different languages. I have validates type and validates subset, which are two validator classes I used and I created during my year of commits that are used for mostly like JSON database column validations for when you're kind of sure of the type, but not really. I need translations for them. So look me up on GitHub. My name is Yez, Y-E-Z. It's pretty simple. My Twitter is Jake Yezbeck. You can tweet me, DM me, and otherwise just Google Jake Yezbeck and I'm the only one in the world and I will come up. So that's pretty great.
Nice. We usually ask how people can find you online. You covered that too. All right. Well, let's go ahead and do some picks.
Hey, folks. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been working a lot on figuring out how to help people become the most valuable developers on their teams or becoming the top 5% of developers in the field. If you're looking to level up, figure out how to contribute more, get the career you want, get the career that you want that will support the lifestyle you want, then you should check out the Most Valuable Dev Summit. I've invited some of my friends across the community, people that you've heard of, people that have worked on systems that you use on a daily basis, people who have invented new ways of doing things over the years in programming, and I've asked them one question, and that question is, how do you become a top 5% developer? How do you become one in 20 of the best developers out there? And so we're going to go ahead and have that conversation with them in interviews on the Most Valuable Dev Summit. And you can find that at summit.mostvaluable.dev.
John, why don't you start us off with picks today?
Yeah. So I actually have I have a couple different kinds of picks from like completely two different walks of life. So my first pick is actually like a time tracking app. So I, for a long time, used Harvest. I don't know. I just got it a long time ago. It was free because I was literally the only user. And as long as I only worked on one client at a time. So I just archived the old one, went to the next one. Right. And then great. It was always free. And I think as far as I knew, the only real competitor at the time was FreshBooks. But since then, I guess I'll just like twist this in here. I kind of got into Trello. I've used Trello for a while. I think as long as you have, you know, as long as you keep your space clean and you have well-defined lanes, I think Trello works great. Obviously, I've seen people make total gigantic messes of it, but if you have some self-control, it's great. But I got into Trello and then I wanted my time tracking app to work with Trello. Anyway, I eventually landed on this thing called EverHour and it's actually pretty cool. It obviously costs money, but I'm already at the point where I had to pay for Harvest. So it's more or less a wash for me. It has the ability to make like some pretty easy, it has easy to make reports. Like, so if you don't want to spend your time in a week, like, yes, I could dump all this stuff out to a spreadsheet, do it for myself, figure some of the stuff out. Helps me to kind of figure out like what time I'm putting where on which projects, things like that. So you can build, to some extent, you can build some ad hoc reporting with it, just out of the box with no work. It does, yeah, it integrates really nicely. It's very smooth to use, and I've enjoyed it. I've been using it for like 6 months now. So anyway, at some point, I just decided that I should tell people that it's pretty cool. And EverHour, you should consider paying me or something. I don't know. But
sponsorship. Yeah, sponsorship.
Yeah, if you're remember,
shut it down. Shut it down.
It's all good.
I'll get you in touch with Chuck, and we can get some money out of it or something. So anyway, so that's that one. And the other thing that I am going to recommend is it's not that I don't have a sweet tooth, but I tend to get like, I don't know, I've just always kind of gotten sick if I have too much sweets or whatever. So there's like a lot of stuff that like, I don't know, I just don't care about because I just don't feel good after eating it or whatever. And anyway, but everybody loves Oreos, and Oreos literally just came out with like dark chocolate Oreos. And I'm kind of like usually picky about dark chocolate stuff because it's always like terrible tasting unless you go to like a chocolateria, which means that you're going to spend your entire wallet. So, but anyway, dark chocolate Oreos are actually pretty reasonably good. So I'm recommending them too.
Nice. Luke, what are your picks?
It's not going to be Raid Shadow Legends after John's shameful shilling. Shameful shilling.
Oh, that was so good.
So I've been working, as I alluded to earlier, a bit on the hardware, doing a lot of Ruby hardware. And the reason I'm doing this is because trying to get the kids into coding a bit. And I'm convinced the way to do this is to do it through hardware. The games now, the mobile devices they've got, the phones are so good that the demos that I thought were cool when I was younger, like basic 8-bit graphics, are not going to cut it. But what the phones can't do very easily is kind of robotics and stuff that lights up and moves. And Python is just completely owning that space at the moment. And Python is an awful language to teach your children. kids are not going to get on well with white space sensitive language, let me tell you. So I know Valentino Stoll's done some great work. I'm picking away at hardware related stuff. And I've been using a NFC tag library by a Titan on GitHub. This is a fantastic library. This not only implements the basic NFC open a URL tag, so you can kind of put a tag around the house and it'll open the URL on their phone, but it also implements the secure cryptographic functions that are used by stuff like contactless payment. It does it in Ruby. It doesn't call out to some kind of black box C++ NFC library. It's really great work. I've only just started digging into it. It's a fantastic project for doing trivial but cool stuff. My other pick is going to be Windows related. So, I've been getting into the MRuby, and I found this wonderful series by a guy called Rorio, where he describes how to build a simple Windows GUI app using Ruby by essentially doing a skeleton in C and then dropping into MRuby. So you can kind of basically use, you know, avoid all the horrible stuff and code in your comfort zone, but still be able to kind of quickly develop Windows apps. And I haven't developed a GUI app since the 90s, and I got quite far with it. But the reason I'm picking it is I got stuck and I need help. So I'm going to pick this and put it in the show notes, because for the life of me, I cannot get this thing to compile using Visual Studio Microsoft compiler thing. So that's my pick, is my comment on that page, and it's a plea for help. Please fix this for me.
So we had a pick for dark chocolate Oreos and for MRuby Rorios. So Darren, what do you got for us?
It's going to rhyme. Wow.
That's a tough act to follow, both of those.
I know, right?
I'll do my best. So I'll build on the theme of, we were talking about reading code earlier, and some people like Jake are really good at it. A lot of us are not quite as good, and we want new team members to be productive. So this is a very simple VS Code extension called Code Tours, and you can use it to create a guided tour through the code base. It's pretty simple. You just annotate each step, and you have a new person on the team. They can just walk through the tour. It takes you in the editor to each place. You can put comments in. So it doesn't take too long to create one. If you have that knowledge, it's kind of a nice way to take someone through the code as opposed to just reading a wiki or a doc, because you're right there in the editor. You can look at surrounding classes and methods. So it's kind of a nice little extension if you use VS Code. So Code Tours is my pick for this week. I don't have anything that rhymes with Oreos or Rorios.
Tourios, yeah, doesn't work.
Code Tourios.
Yeah, Code Tourios.
Thanks, John. Oh man, yeah. I need to set that up on work, and then it'd be like, okay, this is our first God class. This is our second God class, and this is our third God class. This is all you need to know.
The Trinity, very Catholic.
This is our spec folder that's empty. Oh, sorry. I work at a place now that does tests. So, but
yeah. Yeah, we use mini tests, so our spec folder doesn't exist. It's all in the test folder. Takes forever to run the tests. Anyway, I'm going to throw in a few picks. For the last few weeks, I swear I've been picking like who, not how, like every week, every show, because I'm really loving the book. So if you're doing business stuff, or honestly, if you're just trying to find more time to do more stuff, I can't pick this book hard enough. So go check it out. Beyond that, I have a few other picks. I am steadily working through some, I kind of want to call them upgrades, but they're more just migration system migrations for some of the devchat.tv stuff. And I'm just working on some vision stuff for devchat.tv as well. So definitely look for some changes coming over the summer with devchat.tv. You'll probably notice some, upgrades to our sound about halfway through the summer, because we're going to switch off of Zoom. We're going to start using a different system. But I have to get us moved over on our show prep and show notes system first. And we're going to be moving over to Discourse for that. And Discourse it's actually been really nice to get some of that stuff going. So I'm going to just pick kind of the tool chain that we're using for that this week. So we're using Zapier and Schedule Once. So when the guests sign into Schedule Once, it hits Zapier, and Zapier picks up the scheduling. It creates the topic in Discourse, and then what it's doing, and I haven't set it up for Ruby Rogues yet, so we'll probably confuse looks from our panelists here. I've set it up for three of the other shows. I've kind of been getting a show in it per day, and then Michaela picks it up from there and goes through our upcoming shows. And if they haven't hit the Google Doc that we've been currently using, then she moves it over. And if they have hit the Google Doc, then we don't confuse the guests by making a move. But yeah, so it sets up the topic and it says, hey, guest, we have these questions. It also invites the guest. So it sends them an invite from Discourse and it says, hey, we're doing the prep over here, right? Come join us. And then it invites them to the topic specifically for that, because it's a private forum. You can't publicly register for it. And then it invites them to that. It actually gives them an invite link on the calendar invite. It puts the topic in the calendar invite, and yeah, it does all that update. It also invites all of the hosts to the calendar invite, because Schedule Once, for whatever reason, it's not set up to invite more than just the person who owns the Schedule Once account to the calendar invite. In other words, it invites, I could set it up to invite myself, me, because I own the account, and the guest, but that's not what we need. So anyway, so it's Calendly, it's Schedule Once, it's Zapier, and it's Discourse. And it's really, really slick, but I'm pretty happy with it. It also does some magic with Monday.com is the other system that we're using. And that's just for the production status that my production team uses to keep track of upcoming episodes and stuff like that. And so anyway, it's really, really slick, and I've been really happy with that. The other system we're going to be moving to is called Riverside.fm. And just a quick shout out for that. What it does is it runs in the browser, and it'll record the video and the audio, but it does everything in separate streams for each person. And it records locally, so you get higher quality recordings. And what that does is it allows the editor then to, like, if one of my kids walks in, my five-year-old sometimes, you know, my 12-year-old will be mean to her and she'll come running and screaming, right? It allows my editor to just drop my audio out, and you guys could keep talking until I can find my mute button and mash on it. And no one will know, right? Because it'll all get cleaned up. And so that's the kind of stuff it does. The other thing is yeah, if there's a hum on your audio, it doesn't pollute everybody else's sound, because we're all on one audio stream right now. So anyway, nice stuff. Pretty happy with that. And so I'm going to pick that as well. And yeah, I'm going to just shout out again about devinfluencers.com/podcast. If you're looking to kind of go from developer to maybe doing courses or freelancing or things like that. Jake, do you have some picks for us?
Oh, picks. Is it in bad taste to pick my own company?
Pick your own company.
All right, cool.
It's in good taste. I encourage it.
Awesome. Yeah, so check out Nomad at nomadlease.com if you want to maximize your rental income. And if you are a developer and you know some Ruby on Rails, or I don't know when this podcast comes out, but if you don't know Ruby on Rails, we might be hiring for you too. So drop a application my way and hopefully can enable some people to get some jobs.
Do you need to be in a particular locale, or you hire remote, or how does that work?
Oh, yes. United States only, unfortunately, right now. There's a lot of awesome talent out there, and maybe one day I can hire internationally, but it positions are remote forever, even after the pandemic. And yeah, if you're a developer, connect.
All right. Sounds good. And once again, how do people connect?
So you can just Google jakeyesbeck.com or Jake Yesbeck. I come up either one. My Twitter handle is at Jake Yesbeck. My GitHub handle is YEZ. Or you just shout really loud. No, I might hear you.
Right. All right. I hear you. All right. So they'll just connect with you and then you'll take it from there.
Yep.
All right. Good deal. All right. Well, thanks for coming. This was really fun. Really interesting discussion on both the migration stuff and the open source stuff.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, this was awesome. Hope to be back.
Yeah, definitely. All right. We'll wrap up here. And until next time, folks, max out.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.